Larry Burns has been the Director of Council on Hemispheric Affairs since 1975. A former defense researcher and member of the Institute for Strategic Studies in London and public affairs officer of the UN Economic Commission for Latin America in Santiago, Chile, Burns taught and lectured for 15 years in the fields of Latin American studies, comparative government, and international law at a number of U.S. and British colleges and universities. Educated at Columbia and Oxford, he has edited a book on the overthrow of the Allende government, has authored scores of articles on U.S.-Latin American relations for more magazines here and abroad than I could possibly read, and the same applies to the frequency of his appearances on U.S. and foreign radio and TV programs. What explains Larry Burns' popularity is that he seems to know more than anyone else about what is going on economically and politically in Latin America and its relations with the powers that be in Washington, and that is why, once again, I have invited him to be a guest on this program. Welcome back, Larry Burns, to Takes on the World. Last Friday's congressional vote approving CAFTA was the closest vote that I have seen in Congress on any issue in years, with both Democrats and Republicans crossing the aisle to vote on the other side. What was the significance of this close vote, and what bearing do you think it will have on Washington's relations with other nations in Latin America?
Well, I think that it's going to cost the U.S. taxpayer a lot of money to fulfill the commitments that the Bush administration made to a number of Democratic and Republican congressmen to essentially buy their vote. There's no question that new post offices and highway projects and federal construction in home districts is going to occur as a result of this legislation. The president's men were crawling all over Capitol Hill the other day in order to get this vote. And we're talking about if two people change their vote, the president's legislation would have gone down. Why all the fuss about CAFTA? The problem about CAFTA is that although it doesn't involve much trade in itself, we're talking about maybe less than 5% of U.S. total world trade is with the Caribbean Dominican region. But this was meant to give a shot in the arm, a boost to the administration's effort to achieve an agreement with all of Latin America, embraced by what was known as the Free Trade Area of the Americas, the FTAA, a negotiation process that right now is foundering because the administration has come up against solid opposition from Brazil and Argentina and other major Latin American countries who are adamant that they are not prepared to move forward on any kind of free trade negotiation with Washington until the Bush administration gives up the current U.S. subsidy to its farmers, to American farmers. That is, right now, there's a $180 billion 10-year program of subsidization of U.S. agriculture, and that converts into the fact that corn in Mexico today is more expensive. That is, the corn produced by domestic subsistence farmers is more expensive than the corn purchased from the United States, subsidized corn, grown by agro-industry, these giant multinational corporate farms that receive government subsidies in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And as a result, for example, under the terms of NAFTA, the Mexican farmers are selling off their land at rock-bottom prices and are illegally migrating to the United States because they cannot economically survive under present conditions in Mexico. Now, up to this point, the Central American countries had it pretty good because they were able to maintain high tariffs, which placed a surcharge on U.S. manufactured goods coming into the country and protected the local agriculture against cheap, subsidized U.S. agriculture. Goods coming into Central America were either have been eliminated or significantly reduced under the terms of a Reagan administration initiative in the early 1980s called the CBI, the Caribbean Basin Initiative. And meanwhile, U.S. tariffs on goods coming into the United States were lowered, and tariffs coming into Central America remained high. So this was a good situation for Central America. But the Bush administration was able to sell to the Central American presidents under tremendous opposition throughout the region by the people there who recognized that this was not a win-win situation, which Bush and their own presidents have told them it would be, but this is a win-lose situation. That is, the large-scale agriculturalists in Central America would win, as would the producers of cheap assembly products like textiles and furniture. That would come into the United States market without a tariff now. But the numerically speaking, there are going to be a lot more winners than a lot more losers than winners. And that is what COFTA was all about. It was to get up momentum to carry through negotiations for the FTAA, embracing all of Latin America, and in which the financial elements involved are enormous, and the obstacles to achieving a successful agreement quite forbidding, particularly since much of Latin America is anxious to unite with the EU rather than the United States because of their bitter experiences with U.S. diplomacy. Certainly such countries as Venezuela under Hugo Chavez and Brazil under Lula and Argentina under Kirchner and Vasquez of Uruguay, these recently elected presidents are cut from a different stamp than their predecessors and want different things for the region. One of them is autonomy and no longer to be driven by U.S. goals or priorities for the region.
So this would be seen as necessarily a political victory for the Bush administration in an area where they seem to be experiencing one setback after another.
Yes, exactly that. That is, the United States has been terribly isolated in Latin America. Ironically, it has a policy of attempting to isolate Cuba and now Venezuela. And in turn, those countries aren't at all isolated. But the country that is isolated, perhaps more so than ever before in the past 30 or 40 years, is the United States.
It's interesting. You going back for a moment, you brought up the situation of corn in Mexico, which is basically the heart of the Mexican culture, and that corn produced in Minnesota doesn't have any human hands producing it. It's this mechanized corn production. And I remember I lived in Mexico back about 35 years ago, and there was a surplus of corn, and to have Mexico forced import corn and not being able to afford to grow their own corn is an extraordinary development. People here don't appreciate that when they think of the immigration from Mexico. We also have the Walmartization of Mexico, in which the Walmart has built huge stores in Mexico City and elsewhere, driving small shops out of business and people to this country. Will that Walmartization now take place in Central America?
Well, you know that under the terms of NAFTA and under the terms of the WTO, the World Trade Organization, Mexico has no weapons to prevent the Walmarts coming in, because if you try to apply zoning regulations, the Walmart management will declare that this is a restraint of trade. You're trying to prevent trade from occurring. So NAFTA and COFTA as well essentially make private foreign companies operating in these countries, makes them almost the co-equals of government, that they can sue governments and get financial settlements from governments, even just because governments are trying to follow policies which they consider to be in the national interest. This is part of the kind of good-natured baloney that the Clinton administration and the Bush administration have sold the American people, which is that privatization is good and the public sector is bad. In the era of Enron and Adelphia and all the other corporate crooks, it's simply there's no intellectual integrity to the argument that public sector economics always invites in corruption and venality, whereas the private sector represents probity and rectitude. You just can't make that argument any longer. And that argument was used as the intellectual foundation for these massive privatization efforts where Mexican private interests, for example, bought Mexican state corporations, pennies on the dollar. There were these fixed auctions that took place, and the president's cronies under Mexico was Carlos Salinas, who was really a person of allegedly involved in major corruption scandals. But a lot of these Mexican corporations were sold off, public corporations were sold off to his friends at rock bottom prices. Part of the story of why Costa succeeded in the vote and why it will fail in actual operation. It's not going to bring in a new era for Central Americans at all, because the advantages that it produces are way outweighed by its liabilities.
My guest is Larry Burns. It's interesting you mentioned about Salinas Gortari. It seems every president in Mexico, from Mexico after he leaves office, turns out to have been a major crook, having funded, whether it's in changing the value of the currency, like Echeverria, that their crimes follow them after they leave office, whereas American presidents seem to have be protected by this.
Right, it's kind of a Teflon operation. Well, of course, regarding Costa Rica, which for long was known as the Switzerland of Central America or Latin America, it turns out the last five presidents in a row, all took major bribes from French and other foreign telecommunication and other kinds of industries to get vital contracts in the country. And, of course, the United States is well aware of this. Its intelligence service is well aware, and yet Washington consistently has backed candidates for various inter-American positions for the OAS and other agencies who were known to have had either a reputation for corruption or a reputation for having drug money involved in their political campaigns. And this was sort of cynically managed by Washington in order for them to be able to facilitate the election of people who would otherwise be very friendly to the interests of this country.
I want to get back, actually, to something you mentioned earlier, and I had mentioned this in the introduction, in my introductory remarks today, about the key votes that turned this into presently a victory for the Bush administration, were by Southern congressmen who've seen their textile factories, which was the basis of the economy in their regions, vanish, and yet they, who were against CAFTA until the last minute, switched their votes. What political payback is going to happen in their situation? Like, you have 15 Democrats cross the line as well. The AFL-CIO has threatened them. Their threats don't usually mean very much. But what do you see happening domestically after this?
Very often these issues have a very short half-life, and people just forget them. There's no question that on any number of issues, member of Congress, both senators and House members, carefully calculate when their re-election takes place. And since there are very few swing votes in America, that is, maybe in the House there are 25 votes, 25 seats that change hands in elections, most incumbents feel that they have a life ticket to Congress once they are elected. And in fact, they usually do. So you cannot be overly hardy and insist that you're going to make these guys remember that about their acts of treachery, and that they undoubtedly were promised boondoggles by the Bush administration, whose operatives have been crawling over Capitol Hill in the last few days, right before the vote, attempting to buttonhole congressmen, getting the president to call them, promising new road construction or new post offices, new federal buildings, whatever it takes to buy a vote was promised. So this is going to cost the U.S. taxpayer a great deal of money, this vote. At the same time, there are going to be probably the American people as an entity are going to lose out of this CAFTA vote, but there'll be important winners, and these important winners are those private companies, the textile industries, the agro industries that make very significant campaign donations to, they made campaign donations to the Bush campaign. And so what do you do? Well, we've been writing some letters to local newspapers. We just wrote a letter to Connecticut, to the district of Nancy Johnson, who is a Republican Congress member, and she made a speech from the floor of the House, in which she said that Central American labor will be well protected. Legislation. Well, we whipped out what I consider to be a very good letter, saying that she absolutely is manipulating information, and there is simply no way that the average worker is going to benefit from this, because he will be exposed to the labor legislation of each country, which usually operates in the lowest level, lowest denominator. But many of the newspapers in the country and private corporations put in ads in favor of CAFTA. I mean, it was no match between, at least in terms of the resources that were available to those who were opposed to NAFTA and those who were in favor of it.
It's interesting. She may have been reading the handouts from the Cato Institute. Here's a quote from the Libertarian Cato Institute, which gets more and more airing, even among some certain alternative media these days. This is from Dan Griswold, the head of the Trade Studies at Cato Institute. He says, quote, "The biggest winners from this passage of CAFTA will be the people of Central America. This will solidify the tremendous gains they have made in economic and political reforms."
Well, that's simply outrageous remark. The Cato Institute is basically, they call themselves libertarian. They're really hard right Republicans.
Yes.
is what we're talking about. And what is particularly vulgar about that is that Guatemala has, in the past 20 years, there have been about 240,000 civilians killed. In El Salvador, during the 1980s, about 75,000 to 85,000 were killed. These are the kinds of figures that are registered in Central America. Many of these people were killed by death squads that were almost entirely financed by rich agricultural elements in these countries. So you're talking about a reality where the democracies that exist in the region are pretend democracies. That is, there are free and fair elections that now take place occasionally, if they're heavily monitored. But while they're free, they're not at all fair, in that the winning coalition usually has the money, the position, the station, the contacts. Their people own the radio stations and the television stations and the newspapers. So if you are lucky enough to win an election, and that is, if you are from the center left on, it's very difficult for you to rule. And the UN has discovered in its peace commissions, truth commissions that it has established in El Salvador and in Guatemala, that in the case of Guatemala, during this period that we're discussing, just taking the Guatemala City Coca-Cola Union, six of its presidents in a row were murdered, were gunned down by management, the management being a Texas-owned company, whose and the head of that company, a man named John Trotter, whose excesses were so, unbelievably brazen. And he would say that they're going to get a contract over my dead body. And, of course, it was never his dead body, but the dead bodies of a lot of trade unionists. Well, this whole situation became so scandalous that the Coca-Cola bottling company in Atlanta had to buy back the franchise from its Guatemalan distributors in order to save itself from major embarrassment. That's the kind of reality there is in Central America. That is, the justice still operates at the end of a gun, and intimidation and corrupt courts and so forth is still the order of the day. But these are the realities that the Bush administration is not inclined to discuss.
And while we're on the subject of violence, I'm going to shift to another country that would fit into the Central American geographical area, the country that shares the island of Santo Domingo with Dominican Republic, Haiti. In our last interview, which is never included in any discussion of Central America, and it may not be just because it's not Spanish-speaking, but in our last interview, you explained one of the problems with the South American forces serving in Haiti as UN peacekeepers was that they came from a tradition of brutal repressive military forces more used to repressing their respective civilian populations than fighting a foreign enemy. And a recent massacre by Brazilian troops in the city, Cité Soleil district of Port-au-Prince, seems to bear that out, what you said. The situation in Haiti seems to deteriorate further, even as it seems to fall from visibility. And what's your the latest going on there?
Well, it goes like this. Every single military in Haiti right now has a grim, repressive history behind it. We're talking about countries like Chile and El Salvador and Argentina, Brazil. Brazil has the largest contingent. I mean, Jordan. There isn't one country there that has a peerless reputation for democracy. They've all been ruled for many years on and off by military regimes. And it really is quite agonizing to think that some of the officers who were junior officers at the time that repressive governments existed and that they carried out the massacres and the death squad murders of the 80s, these junior officers are now senior officers. They're the command of these various military units. Brazil was under military rule from 1964 into the 1980s. These countries aren't paragons of democracy at all. I mean, and sadly, Lula of Brazil, who was a very engaging figure and ran a campaign discussing worker rights and so forth, he has become absolutely non-operational when it comes to the conduct of the Brazilian military. The UN peacekeeping force in Haiti has turned out to be a murderous body that frequently links up with the outrageously notorious Haitian National Police, who are so detested by the Haitian population that these police wear black masks. They always are wearing masks because they don't want to be known to the public. They are the killers rather than the defenders of the civilian population. Now, this is not an issue that is Kofi Annan and the Bush administration, Secretary of State Powell, and the Ville de Paris, the French prime minister who then was foreign minister, the Canadians. These have all been guilty in basically saying that what Haiti gets, the misery of Haiti today, is good enough for a country that deserves a little better and that just doesn't have the capacity to maintain democratic rule. There's a kind of shocking sense of patronization that these nations that I just mentioned and the UN have exhibited towards Haiti. And elections are coming up in October and November, first local elections and national elections. There is no way that these elections are going to be adequate or going to be fair or going to be democratic. Because the most important party, the party of the ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the Lavalas party, probably will not be allowed to run. Already the campaign to prevent them from running has begun. And you're going to have people becoming more and more desperate in Haiti, taking more and more to these rickety ships, plying the 500 miles to Florida, with many of them being drowned along the way. The lack of justice towards Haiti is simply staggering.
And interesting the way the Haitian immigrants coming from the genuine repressive regime are treated when they land or try to land on American shores as opposed to those coming from Cuba.
Exactly. That is, if you're pulled out of the water, if you're Haitian, they drop you and you sink down again. And if you're Cuban, you're taken to shore and most likely given parole status and eventually residence in this country.
Are there still Haitians in detention here in the United States? This is a story that's never been there was a story about this some time ago, but I haven't seen anything lately. It doesn't mean it isn't happening.
I'm almost certain that in Chrome, the Department of Immigration's detention center in Florida, that there certainly are Cubans who have being sent back to Cuba because of a criminal background, and most likely there are Haitians there as well.
Well, we have reached the point where it's the listener's time to call in, and the number here is 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117. We have a caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. Do you see any movement of the Chinese into Central and South America? Do you see them moving into, say, the energy-rich countries? Thank you.
There's no question. There's no question that Chinese are arriving, and the era of Chinese communism is really over. This is a kind of plutocratic society with a ever-burgeoning consumer class. So it is quixotic to be sentimental about China. I mean, if you look at China today, it's probably more capitalized than even the United States is. Chinese are coming in as businessmen. They are, first of all, winning political support by buying the foreign policies of a number of smaller countries, like places like Barbados and Grenada and Dominica. I mean, the Dominica, which may have an annual budget of $90 million, they were just given an aid package by the Chinese of $93 million. Some of these islands used to be supporters of Taiwan, but because of the Chinese have offered aid or new soccer stadiums or medical programs, educational scholarships, these countries are broken with Taiwan. And for purely fiduciary purposes, they've linked up now with China. Now, China is coming in. It's visiting Mexico and Canada and Venezuela, three prime areas that supply oil to the United States, and they're saying, we want oil, we want to buy oil, we want to do business with you, we want to sell you, we want to buy soy from you, we want to buy oil from you. And they go to Cuba, and they're buying nickel from Cuba. They set up a large plant there. They are uninterested in politics. They just want to do business. Now, of course, the United States is being polite about all of this, but privately, they're terrified of the challenge that China is making to this country's export resource base.
We have another caller. Thank you for that. Let's see. Another caller, you're on the air. Hello.
Yes, thank you for this fascinating show. What do you think the placement of John Negroponte in some newly created security thing here in our own United States bodes in terms of political organizing against this regime?
Well, John Negroponte is an example of a man who Lozondo-like, smoothly, he has moved from one post to another in a favored life. He's ended up as kind of the head security czar, an enormously important position, and he has been allowed to bypass his period of service or disservice in Honduras during the early 1980s, when he essentially was the Gauleiter of Honduras and presided over the creation, training, and financing of a death squad that would eliminate, what all told, about 250 Honduran educators and journalists, anyone who opposed Honduras being used as a contraland, the base for the Contras, to launch raids against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Now, Negroponte has absolutely lied. He has he's had selective cases of amnesia. There was an extremely strong case against Negroponte. And people like Barbara Boxer, although not Dianne Feinstein, who absolutely acted like a slug in these hearings. But Barbara Boxer posed very good questions about Negroponte's past. But eventually people would say, well, you know, that's the past, but let's get on with it. And that's what his wife said, his Negroponte's wife, responding to critics like ourselves. She said, you know, these people have no life. They keep on reminding of my husband of of events that occurred 20 years ago. Yes, this man, as ambassador to Honduras, sanctioned the killing of taking of lives that he could have prevented these people from being killed. The fact is that he has been confirmed in such a high post of kind of national security, anti-terrorism, in this administration is an abomination. It's essentially crime without punishment.
Well, speaking of abominations, we have John Bolton now going to be representing the United States at the UN. What do you have to say about Mr. Bolton?
Well, we came out with a press release yesterday, which I commend to your listeners to take a look at. Go to our website, COHA, C-O-H-A, at COHA, C-O-H-A, .org. And we did something about the creation of this new kind of anti-Castro initiative of $60 million funded thing to prevent Raul Castro, Castro's brother, from succeeding as the leader of Cuba. And we also have a lot to say about Roger Noriega, who just resigned as Assistant Secretary of Inter-American Affairs, a real thug, and also John Bolton. John Bolton is a certifiable liar. He is a coward in terms of making accusations but refusing to appear before bodies like the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to be quizzed on the veracity of his statements. He's a person totally outside the dialogue of diplomacy. He discussing issues. He's an extremist. He's a zealot. He's a very dangerous man. And thus, he qualifies to be, uniquely qualifies to be a high nomination by the Bush administration, because the Bush administration specializes in appointing the Antichrist to be the head of the church. And it is done this with Negroponte. It has done this with Noriega, with Otto Reich, with Elliot Abrams, with John Poindexter. It's almost revenge time. It's payback time for the Democrats ousting these people. So irrespective of the record, and some of these people were indicted perjurers and so forth, they all become prime candidates for senior appointments. And that's how the John Bolton nomination has to be seen. It's a recess appointment, which means he will only be able to stay there for a year. He'll be able to do a great deal of damage in a year because who he is. That is, the man simply has no self-control. We've been tracking him for years. I always felt that, you know, this is a man whose problems were as much mental as they were in the realm of ideas. That is, the magnitude of his transgressions, he is one of the prime causes for the Iraqi war. That is, he was one of the people who came up with falsified information. He played a very important role in this. There's a file on him which the administration has refused to make public to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And that's why the president opted for a recess appointment rather than wait and present his name to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for the so-called up-and-down vote it so desperately wanted on everything else.
You mentioned Cuba, and there is this new program to plan regime change in Cuba. Perhaps you could, in the next just about a minute, kind of run that down.
Well, this is Condoleezza Rice the other day announced this program, and this is a program that will be, there's been about $40 or $50 million of public funds already being channeled to Cuban American groups in Miami and in Washington, as well as to so-called Cuban human rights activists. That is, most Cuban human rights activists refuse to take any U.S. money. The people taking U.S. money are being handed out by the head of the interest section, who is a real zealot. Unfortunately, I forgot his name for the moment. This summit has just been announced by the president, by the Secretary of State. It means that almost $100 million is being arranged for these slush funds to be spent on various anti-Castro causes. For the most part, this money is being totally wasted. It's being used for high living by these Cuban American organizations. There's very little auditing taking place. It's basically the President Bush rewarding those who supported his Florida political campaign.
Larry, can we get more information about this on your website?
Yes, you can.
Okay, we're running down. Larry, again, you've done a great job in bringing all this information to us. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it, and I'm sure our listeners appreciate you having been here again. Larry Burns, the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. And what, again, is that website?
It's COHA, C-O-H-A, at COHA, COHA.org.